Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Hello and welcome to The Lorehounds, your guides to unexpected extras. I'm John.
And I'm Marilyn. And this is the first ever Lorehounds Lanyap, a small gift to a customer by a merchant at the time of purchase. A bonus, an extra gift.
And since you've all given us the gift of your listening time, this one's for everyone.
Today we're offering a recording of a talk that I gave as part of Signum University's New England MOOT on October 19th, 2024. The talk is entitled The Double-Edged Chisel, Tolkien and the Perilous Knowledge of Creativity.
Marilyn, that was an absolutely fantastic lecture, paper, however you want to call it, presentation.
Talk.
I had the privilege of witnessing it, and we managed to get a recording of it down out of my computer. So we are going to play the full thing right after we're done talking here, and I'm excited to re-listen to it.
Well, thanks, John. That's really kind. I'm so glad you were able to experience it, and that's lovely feedback. And just for people who don't know, what is a moot? If you have read Lord of the Rings, you will probably remember the Ent moot. Moot is simply an Anglo-Saxon word.
Is that where this is coming from?
Oh, yeah.
I never put that together the whole time.
The things you learn when you get into podcasting. Yeah, it comes from an Anglo-Saxon term that just basically means meeting or gathering. And so oxen moot was probably one of the earliest, if not the one to get it all rolling. This is the product of the Tolkien Society in England, and they started having an annual oxen moot or gathering in Oxford, oxen being the medieval name for Oxford. And so now everybody has moots all the time. But this particular one, as I said, was the New England moot, Signum University. Signum has just sows the seeds of moots all over the country, and actually in other countries as well. They had an Oz moot, and I think they did one in Austria, but somewhere in Europe I know they did one too.
There's plenty of moots. If you go to the Signum website, I guess I should plug the Signum website in the show notes as well.
Yes, do that, John.
And you can click on their website. They have like a list of moots that they do. Mm-hmm. So you can find one local to you, hopefully, and be able to check out one of these next time they do one.
And they're hybrids, so if you're not nearby but you are interested in the topic, you can still zoom in. And
That's what I did.
Exactly what you did. So this moot's theme was wicked wisdom and forbidden knowledge, which produced papers on things like Thelema. My favorite one, So You Want to Be a Vala, which I wish you had been there, John, because it really would have answered some of your case against Manwë, I think. Somebody was talking about the Dark Crystal and Tolkien and Gnosticism. So as you can see, it was quite a wide range of papers. So let's hear the talk. We hope you enjoy it. And please feel free to write in if you have any feedback. Just hop onto the Discord and we'll converse away. That's much easier, actually, than the email.
Keep it nice and casual.
Yeah. So here is the Double-Edged Chisel, Tolkien and the Perilous Knowledge of Creativity.
Thank you.
Well, Elrond tells us that going last is the position of honor. So I don't know if that's what Corey had in mind or whoever it was that set up the schedule, but thank you for that. It's also fun to go last because you hear a lot of what you're going to say said in other ways by other people. So I'm hoping that you will hear the connections between what I have to say today and what we've already heard. So I'm calling my talk The Double-Edged Chisel, The Perilous Knowledge of Creativity. And I would like to thank you all for still being here, and I would like to thank all the people on Zoom for still being here. Celebrimbor, Narvi, and pretty much every dwarf you've ever heard about. Sauron, Feanor, Aldarion, Aule, Sauron, Morgoth. At some point in their lives, and perhaps for all of their lives, they were crafters, makers, creators. Creatures of a creator god need to do their own sub-creation. This was one of Tolkien's major themes and could be considered as one side of the chisel in the title of this talk. All the names that I mentioned above are names of famous creators. Yes, even Morgoth, in his early origins, created new melodies. Unfortunately, he was not content with that creation. He wanted to make things of his own, things that no one had ever thought of before, and he wanted to rule over them, to possess them utterly, along with everyone else's creations. In essence, he wanted to be God, but that position had already been filled. Eventually, he lost his creativity in a painfully long fit of destructive nihilism and was cast into the void. Unfortunately, he left a lot of his creativity behind him. What about these other creators? Aule was the maker, the Vala of making, smithing, creating. Notice, smith, keep that in mind. Put a pin in that, as they say. And he came within a hair's breadth of crossing a line, the same line that Morgoth crossed. It was only Aule's humility that allowed him to step back from that line, even to the extent of offering up his own creations for Eru to destroy. As a result, Eru blessed the work and gave it the secret fire, thus creating an entire people who were themselves the creatures of a creator archangel, if you will, born to create. And Narvi the dwarf was a pretty successful exemplar of that, so far as we know, even allowing his love of creation to do what none of his people had done before, create a deep friendship with an elven creator, Celebrimbor, which resulted in a monument to that friendship which lasted thousands of years after both of them were gone. Say friend and enter. Celebrimbor, alas, fell into a different problem. Perhaps he had in him too much of his grandfather Feanor, also named above, who dared to put crystalline limits upon sacred light that was the creation of others, imprisoning it even as he unknowingly preserved it after its source was destroyed. Celebrimbor, too, thought in terms of preservation of nature, of substances that he himself had not made. He wanted to make artifacts that would preserve mortal things that were not meant to last forever. And in the end, that desire caused an enormous amount of trouble. Yet it also brought about a grace that he and others needed in the battles with yet another creator who had dedicated himself to Aule, at one point, Sauron himself. Sauron wanted to create a world order in which everyone would obey him. Does this sound like a familiar desire for a position that was already filled? Sauron also, for a time, was a follower of Aule, just like a certain Maia, who eventually wanted to be Sauron's replacement, one Saruman. After a while, it starts to make you suspicious about this whole creativity thing, does it not? And Aldarion? Well, Aldarion wanted to create ships that could sail far across the sundering seas. He wanted to build harbors that could safely keep those ships on the hither shores of Middle-earth. Eventually, he wanted to create armadas of ships because his friends Gil-galad and Círdan needed the help of Eldarion's people to prevent Sauron from enacting his so-called creative plan to rule all of Middle-earth. Once again, though, Aldarion ignored the fact that there were limits to creativity. In this case, the amount of timber available without clear-cutting and the ability of his harbors to withstand the power of the sea to destroy much of what he created. This produced new problems. notably a fierce enmity from the indigenous folks of the region west of the White Mountains, who didn't think much of resource colonization. In the Third Age, they were known as Dunlendings. It's enough to give creativity a bad name. So why did Tolkien consider creativity the right of his sub-creative creatures? And why did so many of his creators stumble, fall, and even turn into the worst enemies of his stories? What is the perilous knowledge inherent in creativity? Tolkien gave us a clue fairly early on in his poem Mythopoeia. Written for C.S. Lewis sometime in the 1930s after their famous conversation on Addison's Walk in Oxford, it's Tolkien's own manifesto for the truth of, the need for, and the justification of myth and human creativity. He wrote in part, very much in part, quote, "The heart of man is not compound of lies, but draws some wisdom from the only wise and still recalls him. Though now long estranged, man is not wholly lost nor wholly changed. Disgraced he may be, yet is not dethroned, and keeps the rags of lordship once he owned. Man, sub-creator, the refracted light through whom is splintered from a single white to many hues and endlessly combined in living shapes that move from mind. Though all the crannies of the world we filled with elves and goblins, though we dared to build gods and their houses out of dark and light and sowed the seeds of dragons, 'twas our right, used or misused. The right has not decayed. We make still by the law in which we're made." Tolkien maintains here that as children of a creator God, we have the right to create, regardless of the quality of our creations. It is a need as simple and as consistent as hunger and thirst. The entire poem, which goes on with many more stanzas that I've given you here, is a justification for human imagination and creativity. John Rosegrant, in his book, Tolkien, Enchantment and Loss, writes, "When Tolkien writes about something fantastical, he is not in conflict with God, but is honoring God, not challenging God, but showing his connection to his father by imitating him." And yet, almost overlooked, Tolkien slips in one very important fact. This right may be used or misused. He tells us that we dare when we build gods in their houses or sow the seed of dragons. The knowledge of creativity is perilous because of the deadly fruits it may produce. Hubris, possessiveness, isolation, and the will to dominate are the qualities which manifest in the creators who go astray in Tolkien's legendarium. Melkor is the most obvious example. He goes alone into the void, seeking the flame imperishable. Isolation. Names all of Ea to himself, possessiveness, declares himself to be its only ruler, hubris, and seeks to impose his will, domination, on every possible element, including the wills of other created beings. Eventually, impulse of creation has all but disappeared from him, and he is interested only in domination and destruction. Sauron, as Morgoth's lieutenant, might seem to be a lesser evil insofar as he wishes to impose order on creation, but it is his own order which will eradicate the free will of all others, hubris and domination, along with his claim to be lord of all things, possessiveness. Sauron, in essence, remakes himself in the image of Sauron rather than retain the memory of Aule, the supreme example of a creator with the humility to submit his work to the judgment of Eru. Because all of them are beings of great power, the harm that their creativity does is commensurate with that power. Morgoth infuses so much of his evil into Middle-earth that Tolkien conceived the notion of Arda as Morgoth's ring, infused with Morgoth's evil in the same way that Sauron poured all of his will to dominate into the One Ring to rule them all. Sauron turns his craft to remodeling, quote-unquote, orcs to tolerate sunlight and obey only himself. The idea that he could then use them to overpower Sauron and take his place was certainly a delusionary form of hubris. But even the lesser beings produced profoundly destructive consequences from their own creativity. Feanor's hubris and possessiveness led to a continental war and eventual destruction of half of it. Or maybe only a third, I don't know, give or take. Not to mention the deaths of countless elves, humans, and other creatures. Celebrimbor's desire for domination was, one might say, much gentler, in that he hoped to preserve the works of the Eldar and the nature, wisdom, and places that they loved on Middle-earth. Yet even the three elven rings were products of domination, because they were made to overrule the natural order of mortal things out of the desire to preserve those things for their own pleasure, and possibly even to recreate Valinor on Earth, another example of hubris. Aldarion neglected his family, his realm, and his role as the king's heir to follow his passion for the sea, which may not have been entirely of his own creation. You know, Uinen may have had a hand in that. But the hubris with which he felled trees, first in Numenor and then throughout the coastal territories of Middle-earth, sowed the seeds for conflicts that would last for thousands of years rather than successfully preventing the domination of Sauron. Unfortunately, we don't really know enough about Narvi or most of the dwarves to be able to truly examine their creativity and its positive or negative effects. On the whole, I would say that Narvi pursued his craft with humility, but even more importantly, with community in the form of his partnership with Celebrimbor, avoiding the dangers of solitude. Aule created the dwarves alone, which meant that they were almost invariably at odds with the elves and would always have need of wood. Morgoth went alone too often into the void to ever be able to be harmonious with his fellows in the song. Feanor also went off by himself to the edges of Valinor, ever seeking new knowledge. Sauron isolated himself in Orthanc, while by contrast, Gandalf was a wanderer among all the folk of Middle-earth, with no set dwelling place. And Celebrimbor was at the center of the smithing partnership of the Gwaethi Mirrodin, and extended that circle out to Narvi and the dwarves of Khazad-dûm, which benefited both their people. Hubris, possessiveness, domination, and isolation. These, if you will, are the perilous aspects of creative knowledge. Tolkien certainly seeded examples of this throughout his Legendarium. But what of his own creativity? How did he fare in his own estimation in using and not misusing this birthright gift from his own creator? Tolkien answers that question for us in both his fiction and his letters. The short story, Leaf by Niggle, shows a small man with a big idea, a tree of tales, if you will. At first glance, you might not think that Niggle was in danger of hubris. He is described as a little man and a niggler, someone who never pretended that his work was more important than his responsibilities to his neighbors, his community. Yet at one point, he considers his picture to be, quote, the only really beautiful picture in the world, close quote. And he himself possibly deserving of a public pension so that he can finish it. He definitely shows signs of isolation, regarding nearly all his neighbors as bothers and interruptions to his true work. Ironically, at the workhouse, he is even further isolated in order that he can learn satisfaction rather than pleasure. Not to mention better use of his time. Oh dear, that has implications for me. But clearly, it does some good. When asked to provide an explanation of himself to the two voices, Niggle instead inquires after Parrish, explaining that he really had been a good neighbor to Niggle and even gave him potatoes cheaply. When he arrives at the foot of his tree, fully realized at last, I can't help but tear up at this, and yet still in need of more work, Niggle realizes that the finest examples of his work had been produced in collaboration with his neighbor Parrish. Quote, of course, he said, what I need is Parrish. There are lots of things about earth, plants, and trees that he knows and I don't. This place cannot be left just as my private park. I need help and advice. I ought to have gotten it sooner. And almost immediately after he does get it. Hubris has given way to humility. Tolkien wrote this story while in the midst of his struggle to bring the Lord of the Rings to fruition. It was, he wrote in a later letter, the only time he remembered writing something down almost at a single go and making very few revisions. Think about that for a minute, will you? It served in some respects as a removal of the block to his creativity. Perhaps it was also a touchstone for him, reminding him of the dangers inherent in his creative life and of the ways to avoid. Though it is also true that in March 1945, he wrote to his publisher Stanley Unwin about the possibility of publishing Niggle in a collection of stories. It had already been published alone in the Dublin Magazine in January of that year. And he included the following in that letter, quote, like Niggle, I want a public pension and am equally unlikely to get one, close quote. And in letter in 1954, he refers to Leaf by Niggle as a purgatorial story when he wrote to Peter Hastings. Once Lord of the Rings was published, and readers were writing to Tolkien with probing questions about the moral implications of the created world, and by extension of creating a world, Tolkien had some interesting things to say about the ambiguity of creativity. When asked if there was a meaning to Gollum's role in the climax of the story, Tolkien responded, quote, into the ultimate judgment upon Gollum, I would not care to inquire. This would be to investigate Godus privite, as the medievals said. Apologies for those of you who know Middle English. We who are all in the same boat must not usurp the judge. End of quote. Tolkien may have given Eru Iluvatar his own name in this secondary world, but it seems pretty clear that in his own mind, this was more or less the same personage as the god he worshipped, and he would not trespass upon that being's behavior or choices. Most telling of all is Tolkien's response to Peter Hastings in the lengthy letter 153. In September 1954, Hastings wrote inquiring on many things in the realm of metaphysics and the nature of evil. In part, Tolkien's response included the following, quote, are there any, so quote, bounds to a writer's job, so quote, except those imposed by his own finiteness? No bounds, but the laws of contradiction, I should think. But of course, humility and an awareness of peril is required. A writer may be basically benevolent according to his lights, as I hope I am, and yet not be beneficent, owing to error and stupidity. Great harm can be done, of course, by this potent form of myth, especially willfully. The right to freedom of the subcreator is no guarantee among fallen men that it will not be used as wickedly as is free will. I am comforted by the fact that some, more pious and learned than I, have found nothing harmful in this tale or its feelings as a myth. End of quote. And it's interesting to note that at the end of this letter, Tolkien wrote, quote, not sent. It seemed to be taking myself too importantly. In 1967, Tolkien wrote what turned out to be his final piece of published fiction, Smith of Wootton Major. It is a story looking back on the life of a creator, this case, yet another Smith, remember what I said, follow the Smiths, who, as a young child, received the gift of a star, which gave him the ability to cross the threshold between the human world and the world of fairies. During his journeys, Smith believed that the star gave him permission to go where he wished and do what he wanted, because it would protect him. This hubris led him into some of the dangerous places of fairy, to other places where he actually does harm, and ultimately into a confrontation with his own possessiveness, when he is told by the king of fairy that it is time for him to give up the star so that another could take it on and preserve the connection between the two overlapping worlds. Smith feels the loss keenly, but is offered the consolation of community by his son, who tells him, quote, do you know, Master Smith, there is much you can teach me yet if you have the time. And I do not mean only the working of iron. Close quote. In these words, I hear the voice of son Christopher. Yet still, Tolkien's doubts continued. In a letter from 1971, Tolkien told a story of an encounter from a few years before with a reader who thought he had found inspiration for Middle-earth in various pieces of art. Tolkien told him that he had never seen the artworks before, and then wrote, quote, I became aware that he was looking fixedly at me. Suddenly he said, of course you don't suppose, do you, that you wrote all that book yourself? Close quote. Tolkien says, pure Gandalf. I was too well acquainted with Gandalf to expose myself rashly or to ask what he meant. I think I said, quote, "No, I don't suppose so any longer," close quote. I have never since been able to suppose so. An alarming conclusion for an old philologist to draw concerning his private amusement. But not one that should puff anyone up who considers the imperfection of chosen instruments, and indeed what sometimes seems their lamentable unfitness for the purpose. I'm going to stick in here. He's probably thinking about just about every Hebrew prophet that you've ever heard of. He did actually translate the book of Jonah, so he was very familiar with that for the Jerusalem Bible. I can only answer, he goes on, of his own sanity no man can securely judge. If sanctity inhabits his work, or as a pervading light illumines it, then it does not come from him, but through him. And neither of you would perceive it in these terms unless it was with you also. So the light has to come through the author, it has to arise from the work, and it has to be present in the reader. Otherwise, you would see and feel nothing. Or, if some other spirit were present, you would be filled with contempt, nausea, hatred.
Leaves out of the elf country, gah! Lembas, dust, and ashes, we don't eat that!
Yes, that was in the letter. Maybe not the accent, but the letter. Of course, the Lord of the Rings does not belong to me. It has been brought forth and must now go its appointed way in the world, though naturally I take a deep interest in its fortunes, as a parent would a child. I am comforted to know that it has good friends to defend it against the malice of its enemy. But towards the end of his life, it might well be that one of the potentially biggest enemies was Tolkien himself. According to Rose Grant, he tried to bring the Silmarillion into a state that was publishable, but that instead most of the final work on it was to try to make it more consonant with Christianity. Galadriel's development to make her more like the Virgin Mary. The tale of the Afterbeth, in which a woman named Andreth hints at a redeemer to come so that humans would not die utterly. Formerly, Tolkien had said that direct representation of religion was fatal to a story, his own word, and especially to a fairy story. He made a painful attempt to revise The Hobbit away from its fairy tale essence and more towards the epic nature of Lord of the Rings. Fortunately, some of his friends gently talked him out of it. He even contemplated the revision of a much-loved temporary flat-earth cosmology, who was an always-existing round earth orbiting the sun with the moon orbiting the earth, thinking that the imagined cosmology could no longer be believable, though he did keep the two trees. To Rose Grant, quote, "It is as though he is standing ashamed before an inner board of examiners who demand the realistic choice," close quote. Ashamed at the hubris of his own creativity, which he had considered a right from God, the imitation of a much-loved father by an obedient son. In Morgoth's Ring, Tolkien wrote, quote, "The Valar must be supposed to know the truth about the structure of Ea, and not the mythological guesses of men, and to have communicated this to the elves." Indeed, the very concept of Earth as Morgoth's Ring, a container of evil will, was in dire contrast to the Catholic doctrine of a good earth made by a loving creator. Rose Grant suggests that this is Tolkien reining in his own hubris by constraining this very creativity. Tolkien's son Christopher put it this way, quote, "It seemed to me that he was devising from within it a fearful weapon against his own creation," close quote. Having maintained for all of his life the right of humans to enchantment and imagination and creativity, why was Tolkien now so fearful of it? Perhaps it was the presentiments of a man who knew he was aging, that his mind was slowing down, and who, as he stoutly believed, was soon to face his own maker. The frustration of finding himself unable to bring the Silmarillion, truly his life's work, to completion, must have added to his anxiety and his distress. Like Auli, like Nigel, he would have to see his work, completed or otherwise, pass before his creator and to see it judged. Surely he hoped for a compassionate God to receive it. Yet, having lived the life of a creator, who knew better than Tolkien the perils, the risks, the dangers of the knowledge of creativity? Given the beauty and the wonder of his writings and the joy they had brought to so many, including, I think, everyone in this room and on Zoom, I cannot but think that Eru did approve and gave to Tolkien the chance to perfect them. I only wish we could see the results for ourselves.
Marilyn, again, what a fantastic talk. I'm glad that I definitely just actually listened to this and we're not just recording this after the intro.
My lips are sealed.
Listen to it when I edit.
Okay.
Which will be great. I can listen to it anytime because now it's going to be on the Lorehounds feed forever.
There you go.
And anyone can listen to it at any time.
And I'll be listening to it for the first time, so.
Oh, fair enough.
that'll be great. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed it. And maybe start thinking about moots, because who knows? We might even do one for ourselves someday.
Yeah, a good old lore moot. So yeah, but definitely check the show notes for all the links to everybody, the feeds, the affiliates, and of course our Discord server where you can discuss this with Marilyn directly. You can also find in the show notes Marilyn's scholarly page where you can find her writings and any other papers. And we'll also link to Signum University so you can check out other regional moots.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
An O'Reilly Auto Parts gift card is the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy-for person. Give the gift of convenience from O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.